This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A little bit later this hour, we're going to talk to scientists who detected and proved the existence of gravitational waves. But first, our own galaxy got its name because of the band of haze running through it. The Romans originally called the Milky Way Via Lactea, the road of milk. Scientists say that dusting is hiding now hundreds of galaxies. Rachel Feltman is here to tell us more about that and other selected short subjects in science. She's a writer for the Washington Post Speaking of Science blog. Good to see you again, Rachel.
Good to see you too, Ira.
Let's talk about that. These scientists use a radio telescope. They actually peered past the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
That's that band of stuff we see in the sky, right?
Right. So there's this swath of sky known as the zone of avoidance, which I think is
really funny.
And it's about 20% of the visible night sky. And it's what we call the parts of the sky that are obscured by the dust of our own galaxy. So it's this area where if you used a lot of optical telescopes, it would appear as if there weren't more stars and galaxies beyond the Milky Way. But using new radio telescopes, they're able to cut through that dust. And this latest study found over 800 new galaxies, 200, more than 200 of which were totally unknown before. And one thing that's exciting is that over near the zone of avoidance is where the Great Attractor is, another great name.
Yeah.
The Great Attractor is this mysterious force that pulls our own galaxy and everything around it out in that direction at a speed of over a million miles per hour. And we don't know what the Great Attractor is, you know, what is creating that great gravitational force. And we still don't know. But now these researchers are suggesting that perhaps there are so many galaxies out there that collectively they have this gravitational pull.
Yeah, I just love it when they don't know more things. you learn more than you know less, right?
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. There was a sexual harassment accusation.
Yes. So at the American Museum of Natural History, which is obviously one of New York's greatest science institutions, Science Magazine came out with an investigative report that they've been working on for quite some time about a paleoanthropologist there, Brian Richmond, who was accused of assault. And actually, the museum is on its third round of investigations looking into the matter. And since then, several previous undergrads who have worked with the researcher have accused him of harassment in previous years. And it's interesting because, you know, it's one of now many high-profile cases that are coming to light in the media because people feel that the institutions involved have not done enough. So it's really part of this ongoing debate that started with Jeff Marcy, the astrophysicist, and has continued. In fact, around the same time that AMNH's case came out in the media, a University of Chicago professor came to light as someone who had broken the harassment policy at the school multiple times and I believe resigned now.
Do you think the Marcy case loosened up?
You know, I think it made victims more likely to talk and to come forward. And it also, I think, is just kind of a sign of this changing tide where, you know, young women in science are really not willing to put up with this anymore. And, you know, older women and older men who have watched this happen for their entire careers are fed up and want to do something about it.
Mm. All right, let's move on to noise pollution in fish.
Yes. So it's not a new idea that the noise pollution from giant ships, you know, shipping cargo, hurts large whales because of the frequencies at which they communicate and use echolocation. But now a new study suggests that smaller whales like orca and, you know, other toothed whales and dolphins might be affected as well, even though it doesn't seem like these big rumbling ships are operating at the same frequencies that they are. So it's concerning because there are a lot of areas where, you know, these toothed whales are having trouble. You know, there are small pockets of populations where, you know, they're considered endangered. And the noise from ships might be making things more difficult for them. Then another study found that actually small fish might...
Real fish. I mean, those are not fish. They're
right,
mammals.
Right. That actually, right. You know, fish, small ocean creatures can also be affected. Mm. And in fact, not only does it seem like they have higher mortality rates when they're young if they have noise pollution, but they are also more likely to get caught by predators. It seems like they're not able to have the same reflexes. They're not able to pay attention.
They're distracted.
Yeah,
by
they're distracted.
Distracted by the noise.
Right. So, you know, more and more signs that it's just another reason we should feel bad, basically.
Oh, I'm sighing, and that's your next topic, isn't it?
It is.
The science behind the sigh.
Yeah. So researchers wanted to find out what brain mechanism causes humans to sigh. You know, obviously we think about the emotional implications of sighing, but it's also a reflex that happens every few minutes without fail. It's a double inhalation you take before exhaling. And why is that? It's probably actually a life-saving reflex. Basically, the half a billion little balloons inside your lungs sometimes deflate. And if too many of them deflate, the surface area of your lungs gets too low and you can't breathe. So a lot of scientists think that sighs are actually a way to automatically reinflate all of those little pockets. And researchers found that the mechanism behind a sigh uses a surprisingly low number of neurons. It's something like 200 neurons.
Wow.
And they were actually in mice, and this was all in mice, they were able to increase the number of sighs by like tenfold by, you know, triggering this neuropeptide that they found. And they were also able to make sighs stop entirely. So they may be able to manipulate that in humans one day, which, you know, for people who are suffering from shallow breathing, you know, maybe inducing sighs would help improve their lung function. And if people were having, you know, anxiety and were, you know, sighing too much, which is a thing that can happen when people are suffering from anxiety and it makes them even more anxious, presumably this could help them too.
So you might sum it up by saying sighs matter.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Rachel.
You're very welcome.
Rachel Feltman, she's a writer for the Washington Post, Speaking of Science blog. Thanks again for joining us. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And this week, regulators in India issued rules that would ban mobile data providers from pricing some services more favorably than others. So that ban prevents a Facebook initiative called Free Basics, which would have offered free access to a section of the internet selected by Facebook. Here to talk about the good and bad of Free Basics is Will Oremus, senior technology writer for Slate. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
So what's to like about this Facebook idea?
Well, if you ask Facebook, this is a really wonderful altruistic program, this Free Basics. It used to be called internet.org, by the way. There was a lot of backlash over the idea of calling it internet because it's not really the full internet. What Facebook is offering for free is access to some specifically selected websites and web services. So you can get on Wikipedia. There are things like domestic abuse information lines and hotlines. You can get on Facebook, of course. It was offering this for free, and people objected to the idea that this could be called the internet. It changed to Free Basics, and it was seen as something, or they were trying to portray it as something, that would really just help people who had no other way of getting online. People in developing countries, maybe they're out in rural areas, they don't have the money for a mobile data plan. Well, here they can get free mobile data. You know, you have visions of farmers checking market prices, of women getting out of abusive relationships, kids putting themselves through Khan Academy on their mobile phone. That was the idea, at least, when Facebook pitched this program.
And so what's the bad thing about this then?
Well, it was interesting. It really galvanized a sort of burgeoning net neutrality movement in India in particular, where people saw this as not an altruistic program on Facebook's part, but really a power grab by Facebook. You know, Facebook jumping in maybe underserved areas and saying, hey, come use our internet. We've got free internet. And then once you use that, you get access to only those services which Facebook has chosen. It ends up being a sort of a way for Facebook to insinuate itself into the fabric of this sort of pseudo internet wherever it's offered and where people adopt it.
So then the Indian government said no way.
Yeah, but there was a lot of controversy over it, and then finally, India's regulators decided that you should not be allowed to offer differential pricing for data plans. In short, you can't charge less or more to people for their data depending on what content they have access to. And in effect, that bans Facebook's free basics because it was offering for free these specific services that Facebook selected.
So is Facebook going to give up on this?
Well, in fact, they have given up on it in India. They didn't have much of a choice. They went ahead and shut down free basics in India. The latest news is that the managing director of the program has stepped down to spend more time with their family. In theory, this is still operative in more than 30 other countries around the world. But I think its future is really in doubt at this point. I mean, you can imagine people in those other countries saying, well, hey, this isn't good enough for India. Why is it supposed to be good enough for us?
Right. Well, you know, this argument, I understand, reached all the way into discussions of colonialism this week.
Yeah, much to Facebook's chagrin. So Mark Andreessen, who's the founder of Netscape, a very prominent venture capitalist in Silicon Valley and a member of Facebook's board, was debating this on Twitter with some people who said, well, isn't this sort of a form of colonialism? You're going into this country and saying, well, here, we'll help these poor people, and we know what's best for them, and they don't get to determine what they get. They just get whatever we're offering because they're poor and we have stuff. He responded by saying, well, anti-colonialism was economically catastrophic for the Indian people. This sounded like an endorsement of colonialism. It sort of confirmed everybody's worst allegations about what was really at stake here. He quickly, retracted and backpedaled, but I think the damage was done.
Yeah, I'll have to find the Gandhi of Facebook arguments coming from someplace. Thank you very much, Will.
Thanks, Ira.
Will Oremus, Senior Technology Writer for Slate. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the historic detection of gravitational waves. Seems that Einstein was right after all, again. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It was called the beep heard around the world years ago. That's Sputnik, and the signal that we just heard is actually a chirp. Let's listen to that again. Oh, that was the Sputnik. I'll get it together here. That was a Sputnik. It was really an iconic sound, the first artificial satellite launched by the Soviets almost 60 years ago. And that was called the beep heard around the world, and it signaled the arrival of a new era of space exploration. Well, yesterday, researchers revealed what might be called the chirp heard around the universe, or maybe more colloquially, the tweet, right? The universe tweeted us. Scientists from the LIGO collaboration captured the first sound of gravitational waves. And that showed that Einstein's century-old prediction of gravitational waves, a part of his theory of general relativity, was finally proven when this signal was discovered last fall. Why has this discovery so excited astronomers and physicists? My next guests are here to talk about that. Kip Thorne is the Richard Feynman Professor of Emeritus of Theoretical Physics at Caltech. He's co-founder of the LIGO Project. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Great to be back with you, Ira.
You're welcome. Gabriela Gonzalez is one of the scientists on the LIGO scientific collaboration. She is also a professor of physics and astronomy at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. Welcome, Dr. Gonzalez.
Hello, Ira. It's an honor to be here.
Well, thank you. Well, let's talk.
And so, Ira, let me just say that Gabriela Gonzalez is the spokesperson for the collaboration. She's the head honcho.
I know she's the head honcho, and no one is calling her that. She deserves to be called that, doesn't she?
She does.
Yeah, I knew that. But that's all I keep saying is, well, let me talk to you, Gabby, first. Let's talk about the moment of discovery. Now, from what I can read or what I hear, is it was a grad student, a postdoc, Marco Drago, sitting at his desk in Hamburg, Germany, during a shakedown run, a test run of the LIGO before it was really online. And he heard the sound, or he saw the tweet coming in?
He saw it on a web page. It wasn't quite a tweet. It wasn't a sound yet. It was a web page that indicated there was a candidate in coincidence between the two LIGO detectors that looked to be very, very significant. And he sent emails that generated hundreds of other emails that day.
And what are the odds? Well, before you started this experiment, we heard all kinds of astronomically high numbers for the odds of actually detecting gravity waves, Gabby.
I wouldn't. The odds were that we were going to do astronomy, and those were very high. I don't know that the odds were astronomically high. But we were preparing to take observing runs starting in 2015 with the first. We are going to do another one this year, another one next year. And we were all counting on the second, on the third observing runs to be the ones that really detected gravitational waves for the first time. But nature decided to surprise us and do it a lot earlier.
Kip,
it was very nice.
Kip, it was really a surprise. Was it kind of lucky to get it?
Yeah, it was lucky. In retrospect, it's not a complete surprise. This signal is almost but not quite strong enough to have been seen in the previous detectors, which the experimental team had built and run in LIGO. And so we didn't know that, of course. But the improvement from there until now is a factor of 3, meaning you're seeing out 3 cubed 27 times farther volume into the universe. The fact that this just below where we could detect before would show up early and loud and clear, well, that's just because we weren't quite good enough before, and we now are much better than good enough.
How did you know what to look for, what the signal would look like?
Well, we looked for many different kinds of signals and based all with waveforms based on the theory of relativity. The one that matched this observation was from a black hole, and that's how we know what the source was.
Mm-hmm. Could it be that we have detected gravitational waves in the past and that it's buried in data somewhere, looked over as noise?
No, I don't think so. The data analysis team that Gabriela Gonzalez and her colleagues have put together is superb. They have the best techniques, techniques that are the equal of the very best in any other field of science and technology. And they have looked long and hard at all the earlier data. There is nothing in the earlier data that is loud enough that it could be a serious candidate.
Now Einstein, 100 years ago, pictured gravity as ripples in the fabric of space-time. But modern science now talks about quantum particles of gravity, gravitons. Would gravitons also be ejected, in theory, during this binary black hole spinal spinning and merger?
Well, these gravitational waves, in some sense, are carried by gravitons. Gravitons are the complementary description of any wave phenomenon. But when you have huge numbers of gravitons, you can't see the individual ones. The huge numbers of gravitons behave like waves. And in these gravitational waves, there are ultra, ultra, ultra huge numbers of gravitons. So they look like very much like a wave, and you don't see the particle aspects.
Do we have something that would detect the particle aspects of them?
No, and we won't have for a very long time. However, maybe you can talk about this, Gabby. We have, from these observations, LIGO has been able to say something about the mass of the graviton remarkably. The wave aspect also carries information about the underlying particles, and LIGO has made very significant inference about these particles, the gravitons. Gabby?
That's right. If you assume the theory of relativity, you can derive a lot of information from the data. But you can also use the observation to test the theory of relativity. The theory says that the graviton should have no mass, and that is the same thing as saying that its wavelength is infinite. And we now know from this measurement that that wavelength is more than 10 to the 13 kilometers. That's a very, very, very long distance.
Yeah, we're not surfing on that thing. Let's talk about, Kip, let's talk about the beginnings of this project. You were there at the very beginning. How long ago does that go back?
Well, the earliest work by Ray Weiss and me and Ronald Drever, all completely independent, on this, the foundation for it. We were all working on it independently, different aspects of it, already in the late 1960s. And so it goes back a half a century, basically. And the foundations for that, that we were building on, and the inspiration was work of Joseph Weber that went all the way back to 1960. So that's what, about 55 years ago.
It hasn't been a smooth sailing all along the way, has it?
No, it's not been smooth sailing. But the remarkable thing is that through the rocky parts of this, our partnership with the National Science Foundation has been rock solid. The National Science Foundation is our partner in funding and in providing us the support in dealing with the outside world, with Congress. And the National Science Foundation, the program directors who began work with us, and the head of the physics division, Marcel Bardon and Richard Isaacson, they gave us tremendous support at the beginning. The National Science Board that oversees the NSF, right through all the rocky parts and the smooth sailing parts right up to today.
Mm-hmm. Gabby, there was a lot of testing. In fact, the LIGO system was being going under test systems as it was detecting these first signals, and false positives are injected into the system to keep the scientists on their feet. And in fact, I think Marco said he thought it might have been a false positive as a test signal. So how do you approach the data when you first received it, especially this one? Were you skeptical that this was a real signal?
Well, I have to admit that the system, the injection system to put these false positives in the data is one of the things we had been testing those days. So we knew that we weren't playing this game, if you want, of blind injections, but we were testing those systems. So the first thing I thought was that somebody had made a mistake and the test was done without informing people. But we knew very, very quickly that that was not true. We not only asked those people, but we look in the data. We have lots of monitor of channels where we monitor injections, and there was nothing there. But that was the first thing everybody thought, that mm-hmm. this has been a false positive.
The way some of the experimenters who do this have described it to me is if anybody tries to do a blind injection, it leaves fingerprints all over the place, and there were no fingerprints anywhere.
Right. So what you've basically created is a gravity telescope, right? I mean, it doesn't detect light. It detects gravity waves.
That's right. That's exactly it. And like telescopes, you can have different kinds of telescopes, X-ray telescopes, radio telescopes. This is the telescope that looks for gravitational waves of very short wavelengths. But there are several other gravity telescopes out there that are going to see other signals, we hope soon, too.
Could you pick up gravity, Kip, for gravity waves from the Big Bang? The Big Bang still around?
Yeah. Our community of astrophysicists, physicists, astronomers expects to. Initially, those will be seen almost certainly in the next few years through something called the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. This is the idea which is that in the Big Bang, gravitational waves were produced along with matter. They traveled outward through the universe. And at a particular period when the universe was 280,000 years old, when electrons and protons were combining together to form neutral hydrogen, that was the last moment when electromagnetic waves would scatter off of electrons. And if the electrons were being stretched apart and pushed together by gravitational waves, at that moment the gravitational waves would put an imprint on the electromagnetic waves. And these electromagnetic waves have been detected and studied in great detail by observational cosmologists using the COBE satellite, the Planck satellite, and then others on the ground, the BICEP instrument at the South Pole, for example. And that signal, that imprint, has been seen, but it can also be produced to some degree by scattering of electromagnetic or by emission of electromagnetic waves from dust. And so that community is working very hard to separate out the real signal which is the imprint of gravitational waves from the Big Bang, separate that signal out from the spurious noise that's coming mm-hmm. off of dust. And that will be sorted out, I'm sure, within the next few years, and that will be an enormous triumph. Looking at gravitational waves with a very different wavelength, a very different period of oscillations. The ones that LIGO sees have periods of milliseconds. These have periods of hundreds of millions to billions of years.
Wow.
Enormously different gravitational waves, enormously different information about the universe.
Well, we're talking with Kip Thorne and Gabriela Gonzalez on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And Gabby, now that we have this gravitational telescope, what can we learn about the universe from studying the gravity waves?
Well, we are already learning a lot. We suspected, but didn't know that black holes of these masses existed before. We knew about very large black holes in the centers of galaxies. We knew about small black holes from information, electromagnetic information from stars around them. But black holes as large as the ones we saw that had 30 solar masses each and formed another black hole, 60 with more than 60 solar masses, we had never seen that. This leads us to understand much more about black holes, where they are, how big they are, how fast they spin, how often they meet in couples and that dance and sing together like the ones we saw. And black holes and how stars evolve and how they form and how they merge in galaxies, that's a history of our universe.
Do you think we could learn anything about the dark matter and the dark energy from listening to the black holes and the gravity waves?
Well, I wish that the dark matter was made of black holes, but we're pretty sure it's not. We're pretty sure that it is fundamental particles that just don't couple very strongly to the kinds of particles that we see. I don't think we will learn much there. On the other hand, with these gravitational waves are very interesting in the sense that the waves from binaries like the black hole binaries or neutron star binaries that spiral together, they give you an ability to measure the distance to the source with enormous accuracy, ultimately. That is a direct observable, as we say. The electromagnetic observations of things help us measure the redshift of the source, how fast the source is moving away from us with enormous accuracy. And so ultimately, if we can combine the electromagnetic observations with the gravitational observations, we then see both the distance to the source and how fast the source is moving away at great distances from the Earth. And from that, we can infer the history of the expansion of the universe with very good accuracy. And that's the hope. From that, we will be able to, perhaps to learn a lot about the dark energy.
Mm-hmm. Gabby, how would you rate
it? It requires combining the observations of the electromagnetic telescopes with the gravitational wave telescopes.
Gabby, in the last minute we have, how would you characterize the import of this discovery?
Oh, it's amazing, but it's just the beginning. It's really opening the window, but now you have the whole landscape out there to look at. There will be many more detections to come of this and other surprises. We were surprised about this one. Who knows what other surprises nature will give us.
Okay, I'm going to leave it right there because I can't get any better than that. Gabriela Gonzalez, spokesperson for the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, professor of physics and astronomy at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. Kip Thorne, Feynman professor of theoretical physics, emeritus, California Caltech in Pasadena, California. Congratulations to both of you and the whole team. And
thank you, Ira.
We'll be watching and listening for more news over the years as it happens. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a short break, and you can watch a video of Dr. Gonzalez talking about the discovery. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com/LIGO, specially made for us. It's a great discussion by Gabby. We're going to take a break and come right back. We're going to talk about, mosquitoes. New kinds of mosquitoes. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the big challenges in beating the Zika virus is outsmarting the mosquitoes themselves. because one of the species that spreads it, Aedes aegypti, can reproduce in just a teaspoon of water. So that crumbled chip bag or that crushed up soda can instantly becomes the perfect breeding ground as soon as a little rain comes by. So rather than use traditional eradication methods, one of the other ideas to fight mosquito-borne scourges like malaria, dengue fever, and now Zika, is to attack the problem from within using genetic engineering. Why not engineer a mosquito that's resistant to carrying these parasites and viruses? Or engineer an all-out extinction of those disease-carrying species of mosquito? Technically, there's not a lot standing in our way. In fact, one of my next guests has already developed a malaria-resistant mosquito, which can pass that resistance to nearly all of its offspring. But is that a good thing? What ethical concerns do we need to address? What biosafety measures or international accords do we need to put in place before releasing engineering insects into the wild? What are the unintended consequences? As the line goes, nature will find a way, or will it? Anthony James is a vector biologist and distinguished professor at the University of California, Irvine. He joins us from the studios of KUCI today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks to have you. Kevin Esfeldt is an evolutionary engineer at MIT. We're going to ask him what that means. An assistant professor in the Media Lab there in Cambridge. He joins us from MIT. Welcome to the show.
Delighted to join.
Tell me, what is an evolutionary engineer?
It's someone who recognizes that a lot of systems are too complex to be rationally designed. But in many cases, we can use evolution to solve the problem.
And is that what you want to do with the mosquito here? You have a long history of this technology, CRISPR and gene drive. Give us an idea of what exactly is a gene drive. How does this technology work?
So it harnesses a natural phenomenon. Gene drive happens when a genetic element spreads through a population, even though it doesn't help the organisms to survive and reproduce. And the main way they do this is they bias inheritance in their favor. So instead of being inherited by half of offspring, like a normal gene, they're inherited by perhaps up to all of them. And that advantage allows them to spread very, very quickly through a population. And we can use that, potentially, to alter the traits of the population, or, in an even more clever trick, to suppress them or possibly eliminate them entirely. Now, this is a technology that is very different from all previous technologies. We will be able to alter entire populations of wild organisms and thus shared ecosystems. So ensuring that these interventions are developed responsibly with wisdom and humility really poses a serious challenge for society.
Yeah, I wanted to get into the technology a little bit and then talk about these challenges. Anthony James, you engineered mosquitoes with an immunity to malaria. How does that work?
We took advantage of the fact that there are a lot of different malaria parasites, those that infect humans and those that infect mice, for example. And humans don't get mouse malaria, and mice don't get human malaria. So a while back, our colleagues working on looking for ways to develop vaccines took some human parasites and put them into a mouse, and the mouse immune system fought them off. And we could go in along with the discoveries that our colleagues made, and take those genes that the mouse was using to fight off the malaria parasites, engineer them, and actually put them into the mosquito. So what we've done is we've given the mosquito a small part of the mouse immune system that allows it to fight off the human parasites. And it works.
So you could theoretically crash the mosquito population, make them go extinct with this.
This technology actually is making the mosquitoes resistant to malaria parasites. So mosquitoes that would normally transmit human malaria can no longer do that because we've given them an additional gene that was derived originally from the mice.
Mm-hmm. And how far along are we in this? And does it make sense to go ahead with this?
Well, we actually have in the laboratory demonstrated what we call the proof of principle. These mosquitoes, when challenged with blood that has human parasites in them, fail to have parasites in their salivary glands and therefore are incapable of transmitting those to humans. In addition then, so we would consider that to be what we would call a cargo. And in addition, we've coupled that now to the types of gene drive systems that Kevin's talked about so that we have a mechanism for spreading these through a target mosquito population. So we have the blueprints in hand. We don't really have the particular strain yet that's field ready. ready to go. We learned a lot from our recent experiments about how to make a better product, so to speak. But it won't take long to make that. But then, as Kevin indicated, there are the challenges of having the proper environment to test this so that it goes out in a safe, efficacious, and ethical way.
Yeah, because once it goes out into the wild, there's no way to reverse it, is there?
Well, that's not entirely true. We have this concept of a phased approach where we take steps to check safety and efficacy as we move along. So one would first find a place where it would be possible to control the mosquitoes with conventional technologies. So a small ecosystem or an island, for example, where if some of these unknown considerations came up, we'd be able to use conventional technologies like insecticides, for example, to eliminate the mosquitoes. So we'd be monitoring as we do this. The idea is not to just throw them out there, but to do a stepwise approach with careful controls at each step.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, you were talking a bit before about worrying a bit about the unknowns that might happen here. Could tell us a bit more about your concerns.
Well, to be honest, a lot of people might be worried about what happens if you alter the mosquito. Is that very risky? Well, Tony's antibodies are pretty specific to the malaria parasite. So I'm actually not worried that that alteration of the mosquito is going to cause them change the way that they interact with any other species. That's pretty darn safe as far as ecological interventions go. Now, if you remove the mosquito entirely, then you have to ask what other species does it depend on. But there are also advantages to removing the mosquito. Then the problem, the vector is gone, so the disease is gone. Whereas from an evolutionary perspective, malaria can evolve resistance to Tony's antibodies, in which case we'd have to do that again if Tony can come up with new antibodies, which I imagine he can do. Yes, Tony?
Of course. Go ahead, and I'll follow up on that in just a second.
Mm-hmm. Would Kevin you advocate then using this for a Zika virus?
No.
Why not?
No, I would not. Now, we may want to consider using this on the Aedes mosquitoes that carry Zika virus. Right now, Zika virus is too new. People are very concerned about it, even though we don't know very much. There have been 4,000 cases, tragedies of microcephaly, but 4,000. And yet, why are we not asking the question of should we remove these mosquitoes because they carry dengue, which causes millions of cases per year and kills over 20,000 people, and also yellow fever, which kills 30,000 people a year. So why aren't we not asking the question about those viruses? Well, because they've been around for a while. Zika appears new, and so we're scared of it. But it hasn't indicated that it's a big enough threat to even be on the level of the things that we already know about. And all of these are utterly dwarfed by malaria, which in the time that we've been talking has killed almost 10 children.
So how close are we to using this technology, both technologies, to then wipe out malaria? If you can engineer those mosquitoes, why can't you do that to wipe out malaria?
Well, here's the thing. You have to balance the potential benefits against the risk. Now, with malaria, the odds that whatever might go wrong, the odds that it would be worse than malaria is pretty close to inconceivable. That said, that's just my judgment, and it should not be up to me, because I'm not going to be affected either way. I don't live in an ecosystem that has malarial mosquitoes, and my risk of getting malaria is zero. It needs to be up to the people who are at risk.
They
need to make the decision.
Have they weighed in on this yet?
Well, that's the problem, right? You're talking about a lot of people. You're talking about more than a billion people. What does it mean for informed consent when you're talking about a billion people? How do you get all of those countries together? Well, the way I would do it is I would say, let's bring together a bunch of health ministers and say, and set up channels insofar as is possible to invite people to say, what are your concerns and what do we need to do in order to meet them? And if everyone can agree on a set of criteria that the technology must meet before it can be released, then it's up to the scientists to show that we can do that with independent verification, entire thing run by nonprofits to avoid any potential bias of the profit motive. And if we can do it, then we can go forwards. Otherwise, it's really hard to see how you could do it.
And what kind of mechanism do you have to get together to gather all these people? Or are we talking about a technology that is so new that no one's really thought about the consequences of getting people together to decide on how to use it?
We've never had to before. We've never really had a technology that affects everyone all at once. It's not something that requires people to go out to a store and buy a product, or even go to their local clinic and agree to be vaccinated. It's a If you build it and release it, it happens. Now, you can, now getting back to your earlier question, mm-hmm. we've proposed that you have, and we've shown that you can build a reversal drive that will overwrite changes or block a suppression drive from crashing the population. So we do have some measures to intervene in case things go wrong. But at the same time, you have to do this risk-benefit thing, and you have to be, and you have to have public support, because it would be incredibly immoral to, for anyone to unilaterally alter shared ecosystems.
Anthony, James, how do you come down on this?
Well, I agree. My language is a little bit different, but we put a lot of time into thinking about what would be necessary for the rollout. And so when people ask about how long is it going to take, you know, there's answers specifically to the science side of things. But as Kevin's indicated, there are some issues that we have to sort out in terms of the community engagement and the regulatory structures. And it is fair to say this is a new technology, and people are only now becoming aware of it, though, like I say, quite a few of us have been thinking about it for a long period of time. The WHO actually has some guidelines that came out in 2014 mm-hmm. for testing these types of technologies. But the good part is there's a lot of interest in this now, and there are some examples of where genetically engineered organisms have been taken into a country, not released, but actually tested in field environments in large cages without the excitement that we're seeing in some of the other places, because good community engagement was done and the regulatory structures were obeyed. So it's just a question now of increasing the awareness and getting coherency in a global manner to this kind of technology. And I'm optimistic that it will happen. It's just unfortunate it's happening under a circumstance of crisis and anxiety among the general public.
Yeah, that's the story of how things work, unfortunately.
It sure is. I mean, it's actually embarrassing. I mean, I started talking about this quite a long time ago. I remember being in Washington, D.C. in the mid-90s talking to some government agency saying, look, you know, we're anticipating this coming. I didn't know it was going to be 20 years away, but, you know, we were anticipating this coming. You know, we should be talking about this. And they told me, you know, well, nothing happens without a crisis. And that was terribly unsatisfying to me, because decision-making during crisis times isn't always the best. But here we are.
Yeah,
so it's unfortunate.
Could mention Ebola in the same sentence. Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. If you just joined us, we're talking with Anthony James and Kevin Esvelt about diseases and fighting them with genetically engineered mosquitoes. Kevin, did you want to jump in and say something there?
Yeah, I think it's also really important that we bring up the need to avoid overpromising. Because just because something works in the laboratory doesn't guarantee that it's going to work in the wild. And even though the technology is moving incredibly quickly because it's based on CRISPR, which you may have heard of in other contexts, it's a method that allows us to very easily edit genomes. And we're moving very quickly. I mean, Tony, you realize that in mosquitoes, how long did it actually take you from start to finish?
For the CRISPR technology?
Yeah.
Or the whole story.
Just for the CRISPR gene drive. I mean, yes, making malaria-resistant mosquitoes has been your career.
Yeah,
you've been the pioneer in that, but the drive.
Well, yeah. So we've been thinking about the CRISPR technology for probably a little over 2 years, and going through the usual academic route, you know, writing grants and submitting grants and getting funded. And we actually had a proposal funded earlier, earlier last year. And we were getting ready to start our work on mosquitoes when this report came out in Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly or vinegar fly, that this technology had worked. And so all the sort of fundamental groundwork and legwork that would have to be done was already done for us. And it was surprisingly quick that within a matter of a little less than 8 months, we were able to adapt the Drosophila system to the mosquito. Now, having said that, it's because we had the infrastructure in place in our laboratory to actually do this with mosquitoes. We have people who were doing the microinjection work, the screening work. We had a complete infrastructure that when a potentially viable technology came along, we were able to exploit it quickly. So the 20 years or so that went into being ready culminated in a very quick application. That is correct.
Let me see if I can get one quick call in. Let's go to Sarasota,
certainly.
Florida. Hi, Fred. Welcome. Fred, are you there? Well, we lost Fred. He dropped out. But people are wondering about the consequences, the unintended consequences, things that you can't think about. Like, you know, if you wipe out all the mosquitoes, what happens to the bats or the dragonflies that eat them? You know, other kinds of things that have to be thought about. And I guess this goes into the bigger picture that takes a worldwide discussion.
Ira, can I weigh in on this
please.
A little bit? Yeah, so the Aedes mosquitoes that transmit Zika virus, dengue fever, and chikungunya are not native to the Western Hemisphere. These are insects that have been introduced continuously over the past 200 or 300 years as a index and a consequence of migration of people and goods from the east from Africa into the Americas. And there were efforts to eradicate Aedes aegypti because it transmitted yellow fever in the 1950s and 60s, and significant progress was made. But we got into the situation that my lab, we call the public health paradox, and that is when public health is working really well, nothing's happening. And in this case, they got rid of the mosquitoes, declared victory and went away, and the mosquitoes came back. And so I can actually see that in the Western Hemisphere, one could make an argument for total elimination of Aedes aegypti and then the recently invasive species Aedes albopictus without having any major consequences on the environment. These are insects that are highly adapted to living around human environments. I hear the argument that these human environments are legitimate
ecosystems.
I've
got 20 seconds. You have another point? Another shoe to drop there, I think?
Yeah, another shoe to drop is that, at least for the Aedes mosquitoes, I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be targeting an elimination in the Western Hemisphere.
All right.
But the drive will spread beyond that back to Asia, and we can protect them, but then they're all engineered. Are we okay with that? That's really what it comes down to.
All right. We'll talk lots more about it. Kevin S. Velt is evolutionary engineer at MIT. Anthony James is a vector biologist at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you both for taking time to talk with us today. It's that season again. There's chemistry in the air. Last words on this hour. Bonds, covalent or otherwise, are forming all around us, so we bring you our custom science valentines. Yeah, need a valentine quick. Written by SFI guest scientists just for you, like this one from social psychologist Jessica Salvatore. My love for you goes way beyond kin selection and reciprocal altruism. So romantic. Check out the whole collection at sciencefriday.com/valentines. Have a great Valentine's Day, great weekend. We'll see you. I'm Ira Flato in New York.